Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Here's an unhappy statistic. Child abuse and neglect are on the rise in Michigan. So why has state funding for prevention been cut? We'll find out more on today's program. And in case you haven't noticed, it is hot out there. But are these temperatures rivaling those of past record heat waves? We'll ask that question in just a few minutes. But first, numbers show more of us are climbing aboard Amtrak trains than ever before. The three lines Amtrak runs in Michigan are often packed, particularly the Detroit to Chicago Wolverine line. Come this October, the state of Michigan's tab for Amtrak will jump a lot. The subsidy will go from $8 million a year to about $25 million. That's about a 200% jump. Why is that happening? What does this mean for you, the taxpayer, and for Amtrak and its passengers? Joining us again to answer these questions is our go-to guy for all things Amtrak. Adi Tomer is with the Brookings Institution's Metropolitan Policy Program, and he joins us now from Washington. Welcome back.
Great to be here.
So we spoke with you over the winter about the growth in Amtrak ridership. Can you give us an idea how has the year been going for Amtrak since then?
Yeah, absolutely. So ridership has been up. As you brought up, the Wolverine is kind of the main mover, if you will, in the state of Michigan, helping to connect metropolitan Detroit residents and other cities along the way to metropolitan Chicago. And ridership there is up about almost 9%, really, in the year so far. But what we've seen overall is that really that's a continuation of the trend that's been going on at least since the late 90s, where Amtrak has kind of grown in popularity, where at the same time we've kind of seen driving levels in the state of Michigan, even though it's obviously the archetypal driving state, really kind of table off. So it's not necessarily that Michiganers aren't driving. It's just that they seem to be showing a real proclivity to take Amtrak quite a bit more.
Now, what is the reason that the state subsidy is going up October 1st?
Yeah, it's a really thick question. So to kind of take it outside of the inside the beltway, smoky room negotiations. a lot of what happened here was, Amtrak has obviously been, kind of been hit hard, if you will, from a rhetorical standpoint on their budgets. And what we kind of always want, your listeners to know when it comes to any transportation mode, it's never free. It's never going to be profitable. That's just not the kind of nature of transportation. It's really a means for us to get to the places we want to go. Amtrak has been really kind of bludgeoned on that level, though, rhetorically speaking again. And what the kind of legislators came up with alongside with state negotiators, so these are folks, not just the representatives in Congress, but also folks on the ground in these states, from the executive branch to even legislators, had the opportunity to weigh in on what can we do to help Amtrak become more fiscally sustainable, but also pitch in a way that doesn't kind of, if you will, break the backs of the states. So they came up with an agreement that essentially whatever Amtrak, kind of wherever they, however much they were in the red, to actually run the train. So this is, includes some capital, but some is not included.
Mm-hmm.
The states would pick up the difference. So essentially they're saying, and in the case of Michigan, it is kind of a nice round number, if you will, even though it's quite large. It's going to cost $20 million typically in the past. That's the loss that Amtrak would have. So that's the bill that gets passed over to Michigan and Michigan DOT in particular.
Although we ought to note, just for a sense of context, that $25 million isn't anything close to the $2.35 billion in state funds that are planned for roads and other transport initiatives. So just a sense of context here.
Yeah, absolutely. That number is really important. The other number we toss out, and I think, again, it'll fit here for Michigan, is if you wanted to add one new lane of highway to urban Detroit, which extends in many directions. Ann Arbor is obviously a different place, but it would be a similar cost, would cost $60 million. So to run the trains in Michigan for 3 years, you can get one lane of highway.
Wow.
And that's a huge kind of difference and a good way to maybe kind of in your mind kind of spatially see the differences of that investment. It might sound like a lot, but as you pointed out, it's a small part of the budget, and you really get an extensive amount of service for it.
So what's the challenge here for Michigan in trying to recoup those higher costs? Because obviously you want to try to raise capacity, but the trains are full.
Right. It's kind of a catch-22. It's kind of the old cliche, you got to spend money to make money. One of the big offers on the table, and I think there's some folks in the state of Michigan who are talking about this, is, how can we find ways to buy more train? They actually call them train sets. It really sounds like toys. If you can buy more train sets, that would be able to run these routes, in particular, as you pointed out, the Wolverine, the biggest mover and also one of the most congested, if you will, then you could fit more seats on. And in the long run, you end up kind of improving that financial performance, which in the end of the day might lower the long-term tax bill to Michigan residents. That's certainly something that's possible, although, you know, we always want to stress that there's both successful and failed experiments at that across the country. And you could be left with train sets that just aren't full and all of a sudden cost even more. But that's one of the viable alternatives. I think what's really exciting about Michigan for those of us watching outside the state, and to be a lesson for other places across the country, is this physical upgrading of the track that the state and Amtrak actually own within, connecting Detroit and Chicago primarily. And being able to own that track, upgrading it to 110 miles an hour, which certainly is not as fast as Europe in some on their high-speed rail network, but is significantly faster than what we have in most parts of the country, that really could help upgrade the service enough that you essentially attract more demand and can make sure that you're filling up those train seats, or even, frankly, just charge a little bit more per seat so you can help recoup some of those costs and the users pay more than, let's say, the entire state.
And those passengers could get there faster and presumably fewer delays, just more on-time performance, and so it's all good.
Yeah, exactly right. And I think there was a representative in the state who talked about how the performance they're expecting when all work is done in 2015, which is really around the corner in terms of building new infrastructure, it would be about 4-hour total travel time. But again, as we talked about at the beginning, that's dropping you off in downtown Chicago, which is really saving quite a bit of not just time, but frankly, headaches on the roads or even getting to and from O'Hare.
So what are you going to be watching for as we get into October? We see the state subsidy going up and then moving toward this greater amount of 110-mile-an-hour track.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, the big thing we're always watching for in the states and the local level is how is ridership changing? The numbers are really promising for Michigan, again, in a state where we're seeing driving really kind of taper off. So this is clearly a growth area. But the big thing that we're looking at, and again, it's a very inside D.C., inside the Beltway kind of conversation right now, is the entire legislation that funds Amtrak and other rail programs is up this year. It expires at the end of the federal fiscal year, which is a September 30 date. So we're watching that to see what Chairman Schuster, who's from roughly your neck of the woods in greater Pittsburgh, what him and his colleagues on the Hill are going to do in terms of proposing a new bill, if we'll pass it on time, and what kind of impact that could have on states down the road. So that kind of $20 to $25 million bill that's hitting Michigan, that was in a bill that was passed a few years ago. So what we're going to look for is if they pass this bill on time, which is always a question in D.C., what's the kind of hit that's going to happen to states and metropolitan areas down the road?
Adi Tomer, Brookings Institution, always a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks for your insights. He joined us from Washington, and we're glad we got you in under the wire because there's a new baby coming any moment.
Absolutely, yeah. I'm happy to have the time as well.
Wish you luck, and thanks a lot for talking with us, Adi.
All right, thanks, Cindy.
No matter where you go in Michigan this week, it seems we're all talking about the hot weather. And when you pop your head out of the door first thing in the morning and it's already 83 and there's nowhere to go but up, that is some hot weather. We wondered just how this week fit into Michigan's hot weather history. So we turned to MLive meteorologist Mark Torregrossa, who also runs a website, farmerweather.com, which will give you everything you want to know about the weather. Mark joins us now.
Good day, Cindy. How are you doing today?
Doing well, except I'm very steamy and sweaty. How does this steamy week in Michigan compare with other years?
Well, you know, I got to say we're starting to become wimps, I think, because it really doesn't compare to the record breakers, so to speak. We're going to have about 5 or 6 days of 92 to 95 degree weather with high humidity. And indeed, that is what I would classify as an uncomfortable heat wave for folks in Michigan. But when you look back at the records, in the 30s, like in 1936, we had a week of 100-plus temperatures in most areas. Actually, Mayo in northern Michigan had the hottest temperature ever recorded back in the mid-30s, 1936 that year, 112 degrees.
And, Mark, you actually kind of point out that for those of us, say, in southeast Michigan who think, oh, it's so hot, I wish I could get up north, you have some kind of surprising news in terms of which places in Michigan have the potential to be the hottest.
Yeah, actually, I wrote a blog about this on mlive.com/weather. And when you look at, say, Detroit's hottest temperature ever recorded, that was 105 degrees. And then as you work your way northward, you get to those temperatures that are 110, 111, 112. One of the reasons why is the sandy soil up in the north can really, really heat up. Usually the sandy soil has less vegetation on it. So you got that sun and hot weather pounding on the sand. And, well, you know how the beach feels when you get out there on a hot day.
Yes, I do. And I'm just thinking of times going down the Sleeping Bear sand dunes on a hot day. And you know it's hot. I'm kind of curious, is there a summer weather trend, or do these hot years show up in bursts? And I guess what I'm getting at is, when you're saying that the hottest temp ever recorded was in July of 1936, that was way longer before anyone ever started thinking of global warming.
Well, the 30s were hot, and it's a couple of things. It does go in spurts, and those are probably natural cycles, but then also you have to superimpose, are we actually having global warming, and are things generally getting hotter? My general feeling is that we are having global warming, and you can't pin a specific hot day and say that was caused by global warming, but in general, the trend is upward on temperatures.
MLive meteorologist Mark Torregrossa, he's been forecasting the weather in Michigan for the last 21 years, and he has the website farmerweather.com. Thanks so much, Mark.
Hey, great to talk to you, Cindy.
That music makes me think of drinking cool sangria. Ooh-hoo. Well, still to come, we often hear about those big names, the Gilberts, the Illiches. They're in Detroit buying up old buildings in the city. Coming up next, we find out about some lesser-known fellas trying to restore a landmark building in Detroit and what it says about the future of rehabbing these old gems. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. If you have ever been in Detroit and driven on Grand River on the near west side, chances are you spotted it. The building that looks like a little castle right there on the corner of Grand River and Cass, with those crenellated turrets looking like something out of medieval England or France. Well, fans of that building will be heartened to hear that it has some champions, three men doing their best to save the GAR building from the sad list of Detroit's architectural gems, buildings that have been allowed to decay or, worse yet, have fallen to the wrecker's ball. And these are three guys, not deep pocket moguls. Let's find out more as we welcome from the Detroit Free Press writer Dan Austin. He also runs the Detroit architectural resource, historicdetroit.org. Hi, Dan.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. So I still remember vividly my first look at the GAR building. It was in the 1960s. My dad was driving me to a concert at the old Olympia, and I remember thinking, what a cool, cool building. What is it? So tell us more about this building.
Well, you know, we're talking about, as you said, the Detroit's castle. You know, it was a four-story building, opened in 1900, and it served as something of a frat house for the city's Civil War veterans. It is the GAR, as you said, the Grand Army of the Republic. So those are the Union soldiers we're talking about. And that's where the so-called boys in blue could go to hang out with each other, play cards, checkers, what have you, swap tales from their days on the battlefield, keeping our country whole.
So just like a VFW hall today would be.
Yeah, like an old-time VFW.
So do we know why they chose to make it look like a little castle?
I think that there are a couple of reasons. The first one's kind of boring, and it's just simply that style of architecture, the Romanesque, was still in vogue at the time. It's almost Richardsonian Romanesque, they call it. That's with the heavy arches and the big old stones, and that was part of it. I also think that there was some sort of symbolism involved. The castle motif showed how strong and mighty not only the vets were, but it also showed how strong the Republic the veterans had fought to preserve was.
Okay, that fits. So it opens 35 years after the war ends. What happens to it after the Union vets die off?
Well, it was turned over to the city of Detroit, and it threw some city departments in there. It eventually became a rec center and hosted yet more card games and more checker matches. a little less exciting than battlefield action, but... and then they also had Alcoholic Anonymous meetings, dance troops, you know, it was just the rec center.
Yeah.
But as the city shrunk and the budget suffered, Coleman A. Young closed it in 1982, and it makes sense. You know, it's sad to see a building close, but when you are trying to preserve finite resources, there's never been a large number of people living downtown, so it just kind of closed. And after that, it was quickly boarded up. And then the city of Detroit did a great job keeping people out, you know.
So it didn't fare too badly then in that time since 82?
Yeah, defined badly. I mean, compared with Detroit standards for abandoned buildings, I'd say the GAR certainly did better than most. You know, the board stayed up. There wasn't a tremendous amount of scrapping involved. It wasn't until, I don't know, maybe 10, 15 years later when some urban explorers got in there and popped the roof hatches and left them open. We had some water get in there and water. Nothing destroys architecture like water. So we had some rotting and the like. Became a giant old pigeon coop. But, you know, compared with something like the Easttown Theater at Harper and Van Dyke or Michigan Central Station,
yes,
or a number of others, it did pretty well.
Now, the Illich operation, Olympia Development, actually had a crack at doing something with the building, but it never happened. Why was that?
Well, you know, you'd have to ask Olympia Development. You know, I think that part of it was the Illiches wanted to acquire a bunch of land over near Fox, the Fox Theater, Comerica Park, and it owns tons of parking lots. Every parking lot that's over there pretty much is owned by Olympia. So it kind of made sense for them to eye that building as a potential development. Unfortunately, the Illich family, while they have done a lot of great things for the city of Detroit, they're not really known for rehabbing buildings other than the Fox.
Yeah.
And I just don't think that the demand or the plan came together. And then to the city's credit, the city said, well, if you're not going to develop it, we're going to give it to someone who will. And that's when we saw the building turned over to Minefield.
So tell us about these three men who are kind of like the knights on horseback coming in to save the GAR building.
Save the castle, yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, it's Minefield USA. They're a company, a small business in the city of Detroit. Tom and Dave Carlton are brothers, and they have a business partner, Sean Emery. They love the city of Detroit. They love the GAR building, and they decided that they weren't going to just sit by and watch another one of the city's architectural gems go to waste. And so they had been actively pursuing or courting this building for a number of years. Even back, they lost it to the Illich family back a couple of years ago. And so once that building went back on the market, they were right there with checkbooks in hand.
I'm speaking with Dan Austin from the Detroit Free Press, talking about the GAR building, the Grand Army of the Republic building. Anyone who's driven on Detroit's west side, if you've gone along Grand River and seen that cool little castle with the little crenellated turrets there looking like something out of medieval England, this is the building we're talking about, and it has been sitting idle since 1982. But because of two brothers, Tom and David Carlton, and their business partner, Sean Emery, there is some hope for this building. Now, these three men are not like the Dan Gilberts and the Mike Illiches, real, real big money people, are they?
Right. I mean, certainly they run a successful business,
mm-hmm.
but it is a small business. They're not gazillionaires like the Illiches and Gilberts. You won't find them on the Forbes list of richest people. But I think that what the GAR shows, it's not just saving a great building, or it's not just saving a monument to the, you know, the Union veterans of the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
This shows that you don't have to be completely loaded to save a great piece of Detroit history. And I think that's one of the most important aspects of this story.
It is. And I guess I'm wondering, as you look at this and knowing what you do know, Dan Austin, about these forgotten landmarks of Detroit, what does this story tell us about the opportunities for do-it-yourself types and entrepreneurs in cities like Detroit?
I think one of the great things about the city of Detroit, and I've lived all over the country, you can't really make a big difference in many other cities. But in Detroit, if you have a lot of determination, you know, you put yourself out there, not afraid to take a little risk, you know, you can make big things happen. And yes, certainly not anybody, just anybody, can save one of these buildings, but you'd be surprised what you can do. You're looking at about a $3 million renovation on the GAR. That is more than I have. However, mm-hmm. you know, compared with something like the Book Cadillac, which came in around $200 million, the Fort Shelby was around $75 million. You know, you look at a building and it's got boards on it and maybe some graffiti, and you're just like, oh boy, there's no saving that. There's no money, no way that we could raise enough money. And, you know, the Carlton brothers and Sean Emery, they're showing that you can.
You know, Dan, when you look at buildings like you cited the Michigan Central train station, we know it's now owned by Matty Maroon, and these are once grand buildings being allowed to rot before our eyes. And it's a story that's repeated not only in Detroit, we're seeing it in other cities throughout Michigan. What do you think it takes to preserve these architectural gems and keep them from becoming the next Michigan Central?
That's a great question. Short answer is will and money. And, you know, Detroit's troubles are well known. You know, there's not a whole lot of money. There aren't enough employees in the city of Detroit to kind of do code enforcement and the like. But, you know, the biggest problem is if you look at something like the World's Fair building, which is over across the street from the Detroit Opera House, you know, that's owned by a lawyer and a judge, so they should have money. The rear wall collapsed off the back of that building. The city of Detroit has ticketed these guys, and normally in most cities, the city would eventually just take it over. But really, Detroit doesn't need any more buildings, you know.
Right.
The last thing it wants is another abandoned building. And if the building, if a brick falls off the building and clobbers somebody on the top of the noggin, then it's the building owner's fault, not the city of Detroit. And that's a horrible way of looking at it, but it's sort of true. That's why a lot of these, I don't want to necessarily call them slumlords, but perhaps people who own buildings that are not in good shape, you know, they're allowed to kind of get away with it because there isn't much recourse. There's not much the city of Detroit is willing or able to do. So I think to stop buildings from getting to the point of Michigan Central, you know, you need to have the city take a more active role in policing the buildings and saying, hey, if you're going to redevelop it, great. If you're not, you need to give it to somebody who is. Boards and all that will do only so much. I mean, you would be surprised at how resourceful some of these scrappers are. And, you know, a lot of it's just not letting the building get to that point in the first place.
Dan Austin writes for the Detroit Free Press and also runs the Detroit Architectural Resource, historicdetroit.org. And he's written the two books, Forgotten Landmarks of Detroit and Lost Detroit. Keep us posted, if you will, on the Gar Building, Dan.
Yeah, it should be open next spring, they're saying.
We'll keep monitoring. Thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thanks for having me.
It wasn't so long ago that Ryan Shinska was quarterbacking his high school football team in Richmond in Macomb County. Then it was off to Ann Arbor, to the University of Michigan. 3 years ago, he graduated from U of M's dental school. And today, Dr. Ryan Shinska is a man with a self-declared mission to end dental pain and bring good dental health to the people of Uganda. Ryan will be moving to Uganda July 25th to open a dental clinic there. His journey from U of M student to opening a clinic to serve the poor in one of the world's poorest countries is one that's worth exploring and sharing with you. Dr. Ryan Shinska joins us now in the studio. Hello.
Thanks for having me.
Good to have you here.
I miss
it. Well, when you first came to U of M after high school, did you ever see yourself as A, a dentist, and B, somebody whose sense of mission is so strong that he's actually pulling up stakes and moving to Uganda to work with the poor?
No, and absolutely not.
So how did this happen?
You know, like any journey like this, it's a long, winding road with lots and lots and lots of people that influence you and events that kind of make you think something bigger is going on.
Mm-hmm.
I would say the main thing when it comes to the sense of mission, the sense of purpose, and the obligation that I feel that we have as people with resources to serve the poor and to bless and be a blessing to others started when I became involved in Athletes in Action here at Michigan.
And that group is?
It's like a Christian Intercollegiate Varsity Athlete Fellowship.
Okay. And then how did becoming a dentist fit into this?
Sure. Well, that's another long, you know, when I came here, I wanted to be a quarterback. I tried to walk on the football team, blew up my knee again, and decided that wasn't for me. Wasn't going to be in the NFL, so I should focus on my grades because they weren't the greatest to start here. And I just kind of bummed around, looked at different subjects. I was on a pre-med track to start. I was a movement science major in undergrad, and I was doing all my pre-med courses. I wanted to be an orthopedic surgeon. Mm-hmm. I blew up my knee 3 times. So
you knew from orthopedic surgeons.
Sure. So I knew some guys that were involved in it. It was a cool job, and I love sports, obviously. Cool job, just wasn't for me. You know, it was super busy, super intense, and I knew I wanted more of like a personal life, work balance.
Okay. And then you ended up going to dental school, and then you worked with the poor in Louisiana, and now here you are.
Yeah, New Orleans and Baton Rouge, okay. Mainly in Baton Rouge, mm-hmm. But yeah, between the two.
So many other folks in your class have gone on to set up suburban practices, and I'm sure your folks are looking going, well, look, here he's packing up to move to Africa.
Sure.
What drew you to Uganda?
Well, I went, when I first graduated dental school, I wanted to work in the inner city.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to coach football. And I wanted to basically, like, I have a passion for tutoring young men. I think a big problem in our country in general, especially in inner cities, is that there's a dearth of male role models for our kids. And I know I've been blessed to have good male role models, whether it be my dad or coaches or teachers, and I'd like to provide that. Even back here in Ann Arbor, like, I got my little brother. Shout out to Chris, Jalen, Jalico, Jason, all from Big Brothers, Big Sisters. And I went down there, and I was going to do a mission trip once a year, right?
Okay.
Kind of go see the world through that. I stumbled upon this article about this girl, Katie Davis, from Nashville, who founded, long story short, when she was 18, she went to Uganda to teach English for a year, kindergarten. And even longer story short, she is now 25, has adopted 13 Ugandan children, and is living out there permanently, obviously, mm-hmm. and has founded a ministry that sponsors about 850 kids, provides medical care, health care, and empowers them, mentoring. And it's like, you know, the least of these even within Uganda, children without parents, so on and so forth.
Yeah.
And she's also written a book, Kisses from Katie, that's become pretty popular, and that's kind of how I got connected to Uganda. So I emailed her people, and they invited me out. So it's been a story from there.
And your idea now is you're going to move there on the 24th of July to do what?
I'm going there initially to just serve the dental needs of the kids in the community. There's no dentist, like, of the 800 kids in Katie's program.
Mm-hmm.
None of them had seen a dentist when I went out there. So a lot of abscesses, a lot of kids in a lot of pain. And God's given me the resources to do something about it. So I think as a follower of Christ, that's something that I should do.
So the idea of living in dental pain, something that we would pick up the phone and call someone like you, is something that's not even on the radar screen for those folks.
Kind of like a miracle. Yeah, mm-hmm. like especially like I've worked with mostly the kids in the Mazima program. But, you know, it's especially cool working with the adults, you know, because the adults obviously have been living with this for a long time. And you go out to a village and this guy shows up from the middle of nowhere and can do this. And it's just that's why I became a dentist. That's why I got into health professions. And we're going to keep following the path. But eventually my goal is to have it not be about me, have it be about, you know, providing like a dental school to be able to empower Ugandans to be able to provide dental care to Ugandans.
So give them essential skills to be able to provide the kind of services you can do to help relieve the pain and
improve their dental
health?
Sure, absolutely. And education is always the main thing. Education, like not just coming and taking out a tooth and fixing a symptom, mm-hmm. fix the cause of the problem, educate and explain why this is going on, what we can do to keep to prevent this from happening in the first place. I mean, really, it's the same thing that's a problem in inner cities. And I love working in the inner city, and it was such a hard decision to make this happen because I love working in the inner city. And it's just, to me, it's all about empowering the community members.
What is the deepest hope you have for what you're going to try to undertake?
The deepest hope is just creating a dental school to be able to empower Ugandans, to be able to safely, compassionately, empathetically, serve their countrymen and educate them to be able to just take care of their teeth. But it's not just about teeth. Like, you know, mm-hmm. I hate when people just, you know, talk
Focus
about
on
teeth.
Yeah.
It's always an issue of the heart. And I think that's the most important thing, is that if your heart's in the right place, you know, I'll take care of it. Because honestly, like, you know I need to be technically, I pride myself in being technically proficient and being really good at what I do. But if you're not connecting empathetically and compassionately with your patients, then what the heck are you doing?
What's your greatest fear or your greatest concern, worry, as you embark on this?
That I'll go out there and then in 6 months I get kicked out and I look like a fool. Honestly, yeah, I mean, you know, I don't know, like, because if I stayed here in the States, I could really, you know, it's a hard job. It's you see stuff that breaks your heart. Like the 3 weeks before I left Louisiana, one of our patients was beaten to death allegedly by his parents, 2-year-old kid, and there's so much crap that goes on, and you know, it was really hard leaving Louisiana just because you connect emotionally with so many of your patients mm-hmm. and their families. And not that I have all the answers or that I know what's going on, but I've been blessed to have great parents and have great role models around me that I can pay that forward.
Dr. Ryan Shinska will be heading to Uganda to begin treating the children and adults in Jinja, a city about 54 miles outside of Kampala. You can find more on his website, hopesmilesuganda.com. That's hopesmilesuganda.com. Dr. Ryan Shinska, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Still to come, child abuse is going up in Michigan just as state spending on prevention goes down. We find out more coming up next. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. Child abuse is on the rise in Michigan. As recently as 2006, Michigan's rate of child abuse and neglect was below the national average. Today, it is more than 50% higher than the national rate. And this surge in child abuse comes exactly as state spending on abuse and neglect prevention has been cut sharply. To try and answer why child abuse and neglect rates are going up in Michigan, we turn to Jane Zender-Merrill. She's the project director for Kids Count in Michigan at the Michigan League for Public Policy. Hello, Jane.
Hello.
And we welcome Kathy Weisenborn, who's the president of Care House of Oakland County. It's the Child Abuse and Neglect Council of Oakland County. Welcome, Kathy.
Hello.
Jane, I want to start with you, and if we could talk a little about the statistics and the data. What do the statistics tell us about the change in the rates of child abuse and neglect in Michigan, say, since 2000?
Well, I've got in front of me the latest report that we put out looking at child abuse and neglect since 2005 through 2011. And what we see is a significant increase not only in confirmed victims, but also there's more reports coming into the state and more investigations going on of abuse and neglect, which is not surprising given the stress that families are under with unemployment persisting really throughout the decade and families really scrambling in terms of foreclosure as well.
Can you give us any sense of which counties have the highest rates?
Actually, it's in some of our northern rural counties that we see some of the highest rates of abuse and neglect. And in some of the counties where we see really high levels of abuse and neglect, we also see relatively high levels of poverty. And this is, again, not so surprising because most abuse and neglect is actually neglect. Parents not having the wherewithal to protect their children. It's really, rather than being abuse, which you read about disproportionately in the newspapers, really 86%, I believe, the department cites of all cases involve neglect at some level.
Kathy Weisenborn, your team at Care House of Oakland County works with the children and their families every single day. Give us your sense of what's behind the increase in the rates of abuse and neglect.
You know, Cindy, we are at Care House would be working with, for the most part, children who have been sexually abused or physically abused. The vast majority of our cases are sexual abuse. We're not seeing necessarily the neglect. We have seen cases rise over the past several years. We like to think we're doing a better job of educating so that more cases are reported, so that children, once a case is reported, that child can get help. But we don't absolutely know that it's more reporting that is resulting in those increased cases. You know, to some degree, really horrific things like the Sandusky case does bring light on this issue. And perhaps the little sliver of silver lining in that case is it has shined light on child sexual abuse so that perhaps that does result in an increase in reporting.
Do you feel, Kathy, that what Jane had pointed to with the sense that the increase seems to be tied with the economic troubles that people are going through in the Great Recession in Michigan, do you think that is linked from what you're seeing?
I don't know that that is a direct link to the sexual abuse cases that we're seeing. Perhaps that stress on the family does have an impact on physical abuse. But one might surmise that you almost have the opposite effect with sexual abuse, that if something is happening in the family and perhaps it's the breadwinner who is the perpetrator, there's a lot of pressure on that child to keep quiet, particularly when that child, that family has economic stress as well. So it's really hard to say.
When you look, Cynthia, at what drove this increase between the 2005-2011 caseload, the big increase came in what the department describes as Category 3. The department, when they determine that there's been abuse and neglect that has occurred and there's a victim that they feel they have enough evidence to say, yes, this occurred. If there's a low risk of that abuse or neglect reoccurring, they categorize that as a Category 3. Hmm. And that's virtually where all of the increase came. It jumped from around 6,500 to 10,000, over 10,000 cases in that category. So what that says to us is that if we had preventive programs in place, that that abuse or neglect need never to have occurred, because what the department does with those cases is refer those families to community services and close the case. But the fact remains that a child has been abused or neglected.
Can you give us a for instance of these Category 3 cases, Jane Zender Merrill, when you're saying there's a large increase in them and these are cases that have a low risk of recurring? What would that look like?
You know, we've had multiple discussions with the department to try to find out what services are lacking in local communities or what services were families not getting access to before the abuse neglect occurred.
Are we talking about, for example, mom or dad are working overnight, kids left alone? Or...
Yep, could be that.
Oh, okay.
Failure to protect. They could be not having enough food in the household. Their housing might be compromised in some way. They're not providing for basic needs. I mean, that's another big change that people aren't registering, I don't think, is that in the last 20 years in Michigan and really throughout the country, we've seen a big change in terms of eligibility for assistance programs and also for the level of assistance that's provided.
Mm-hmm.
And so people who, families, parents who are trying to meet the needs of their children during this recession are far worse off than previous generations. Previous generations would have qualified for eligibility at much higher rates of income, and they also would have had a much more substantial level of assistance. For example, right now, if you're a single mom, you lose your job, you're not eligible for unemployment because you work part-time at a retail or restaurant. So your income would not make you eligible for unemployment. So you apply for cash assistance. The amount of you have to have an income under $812 gross monthly income in order to qualify, and that's well below the poverty level. So a lot of families who are in that margin between $812 and I believe it's almost $1,300 for a family of three aren't eligible for anything but perhaps food stamps.
And yet one would think with this increase in reports of abuse, you'd think it would lead to an increase in state funding for prevention programs, but exactly the opposite has happened, hasn't it?
Exactly.
We had a wonderfully successful program that CareHouse participated in that was called a prevention pilot, mm-hmm. where we partnered within Oakland County with several other organizations, and we were working with families that were at risk, that were your Category 3 or Category 4 type families, and providing them with education, with other types of assistance programs, and when we measured the results on that program, it was incredibly successful. Over 95% of the families that went through the prevention pilot had no additional reports to protective services. So you can see that there are really effective prevention programs out there. Unfortunately, that was federal funding that dried up last fall. So we don't have that program anymore in Oakland County or across the state.
I'm speaking with Kathy Weisenborn. She is the president of CareHouse of Oakland County, and with Jane Zender Merrill, who's with Kids Count in Michigan at the Michigan League for Public Policy, looking at the increase in Michigan's rate of child abuse and neglect in recent years, particularly between 2005 and 2011, and the fact that at the same time we're seeing federal and state funding for prevention programs and education programs and intervention drying up. So I have to ask both of you, with the federal and state dollars drying up, what options remain? Jane, I'll start with you.
Well, I think we need to advocate for the priorities in the budget that we think are important. Clearly, there is money for those things that we think are priorities. We were able in Michigan to provide a $1.6 or $8 billion tax break for businesses a few years ago. And we have this pool of money that we all pay into with our sales tax and income tax and the various sources of revenue that come into the state. And our legislature divides up that pie and decides where the money is going to go. So as advocates for children and families, we need to be at the forefront, making sure that those resources that families need during economic hard times, which are inevitable, the business cycle goes up and down. And in Michigan, we should know that better than any other state.
Mm-hmm.
And children who grow up after experiencing abuse and neglect in particularly in early childhood, have long-term outcomes that affect them oftentimes the rest of their lives. So we can ill afford to see these rates go up and see more children damaged because we as a society did not extend the help to their families that was needed through no fault of their own. I mean, unemployment is high. It's very difficult for people to find jobs. And the other dynamic that we have going is that people are often taking several part-time, low-paying jobs. So even if they find a job, it may not lift them above poverty level so that they can afford housing, which keeps going up.
And Kathy Weisenberg, from where you sit at CareHouse in Oakland County, what do you see as options, realizing that state and federal dollars just aren't there?
I mean, we as an agency have very much focused on trying to expand our base of private funding, whether that's through corporate foundations, other foundations, private donors. 40 to 50% of our funding each year we are raising through those sources. So what we find is that as state and federal dollars shrink, that becomes that much more important to expanding the private funding. And to the extent that there is a program like the prevention pilot where we lose the state funding, that was something we just couldn't replace. And unfortunately, then we cannot offer that program. So we really try not to get ourselves in those types of situations by kind of expanding that base of private funding.
Kathy, what are the biggest misconceptions you think that the public and our lawmakers and leaders, both state and federal, but we're really talking about the state, who we want to focus on Lansing. What are those biggest misconceptions you think they have about child abuse and child abusers?
In particular, I think there's a, particularly about sexual abuse, there's a perception that it doesn't happen in my community. And we know that sexual abuse, physical abuse, also happens across all socioeconomic backgrounds. It happens in Oakland County, in Washtenaw County, in all counties across the state, and it's a problem that you have to deal with, not by closing your eyes and pretending it isn't there. There's a misconception, for example, that if a child is being abused, they're going to say something about it, and we know that 80 to 90% of cases of abuse are never reported. So imagine how many kids are out there suffering in silence because they're not being reported. These are the types of things that we have to continue to educate on, and hope that that type of education will bring additional funding.
Let's look ahead. What do you both think the gradual economic recovery in our state will do to impact the rates of child abuse? Do you see it increasing? Do you see it decreasing?
Well, one of the challenges around these statistics is that child abuse or child welfare services is somewhat driven by how many investigators you have in the field to respond to allegations. We now have a centralized reporting system, but it varies a lot across the country based on what the definitions are and what current policy is, for example. Michigan is under a huge pressure to keep the numbers down of kids that are going into foster care. We know that, just off the top, we know that kids that go into foster care, even if they've been abused and neglected, it's another trauma for them to be taken from their family and the only caretakers they've ever known. And often kids languish in foster care, which has been a big issue in Michigan. So there's lots of issues around how the system works in a particular state and what the levels of funding are in terms of how the numbers can go up and down as well.
Do you feel now that what you had pointed to with the economic downturn and the Great Recession and direct impact that seemed to have on the increased rates you reported from 2005 to 2011, do you think that will get better as the economy improves?
We can hope that it does, but we still see child poverty rates going up, which means that families are still struggling, even though we're in, quote-unquote, a recovery. So I think there's a lot of issues around people making enough money to provide for the basic needs of their kids.
Kathy, where do you see things going?
I agree with Jane in that rates of child poverty are going to continue to impact specifically neglect cases. One would hope that with economic recovery and a little bit more money coming into the state coffers, there's perhaps more money available to fund prevention programs that can be so successful, and there can be hopefully more wherewithal within the general public to fund through donations the types of agencies like ours that are so effective at providing services to this population.
I'd like the thoughts of each of you to wrap up. The number one thing that our leaders in Lansing and Washington should do to protect our children. Kathy Weisenborn, what do you think that is?
I think the number one thing is to ensure a robust child protection apparatus, if you will, at Department of Human Services, and encouraging all of the parties within state government, law enforcement, prosecutors' offices to work together toward the protection of children.
And Jane Zender Merrill, your thoughts?
I would say that since neglect is the biggest factor driving these data, I would see that it's really important to reestablish our prevention programs at the local level and to make sure they're wide-ranging. We know that our most vulnerable kids are our preschool kids, particularly infants. And if we don't reach those families and those children with support programs so that we don't have this level of incidence, we will have far too many young people growing up with huge burdens, social and emotional burdens, through the rest of their lives.
And then who knows the impact, can't even measure it, on the future generations.
That's right.
That was Jane Zender Merrill. Jane's the project director for Kids Count in Michigan at the Michigan League for Public Policy. She joined us from Lansing. And we also spoke with Kathy Weisenborn, who's the president of Care House of Oakland County, the Child Abuse and Neglect Council of Oakland County. And she joined us from Pontiac. Thank you so much to both of you for joining us on Stateside.
Thank you for having us.
Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Peg Watson. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening, and let's talk tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock.